Bondage and liberation is the topic we are considering today. The general ideas of bondage is something that we can examine to begin with. The word bondage means restraint of some kind, being bound, being enslaved, loss of freedom, and so on. Liberation is the opposite of it, being free, unfettered, unchained, and so on. Generally speaking, we all have our peculiar likes and dislikes. When somebody in life or the circumstances of life put us in a position where we are not able to exercise our likes or get what we like and avoid what we dislike. If we are not in a position to do that, then we feel bound. Then we feel there is a bondage. For an unethical businessman, the rules which the government puts in place for a fair trade, those rules becomes bondage for an unethical businessman. For a lazy student, preparation to the examination, appearance to and giving the examination becomes very he feels that he is bound. So license to do anything we want, full free, without any constraints, whatever we want to do, that appears something very, very something that attracts us. But when the correct conception of man's essential nature and the reason for our existence, the reason why we are here, when these are understood correctly, then the whole view becomes reversed. What was earlier seen as bondage would be seen as something to be followed willingly. How it is, we'll come to that. There is another kind of bondage. When we say bondage, slavery, it can refer to something else also, which is slavery of one section of the society by one class of people by another class. We had slavery is government has abolished slavery. Governments have abolished slavery, but there is a different kind of slavery. There is no colonization as it was a century ago, but there is economic colonization. But we are not discussing these topics today. While a student of life would provide his full support for the political and economic freedom of the masses, he also sees that the cause for all these various aberrations, these various negative conditions in mankind, the cause for all these are not in the political or the economic models that we are using in themselves, but they are to be traced to the character of man. The root cause for all the problems of the world lies ultimately in the moral nature, character of man, individually as well as collectively. And the true student of life strives to address the problem in its, on its causal plane, not merely tinker with the effects. Now take all the physical constraints and physical, what shall we say, disadvantages. These are all temporary, isn't it? When the conditions of life changes, when life puts us in a different set of circumstances, what we had thought as bondage or slavery or restriction would have changed, and we would be in a different position, different station in life. So life keeps on, our circumstances of life keep on changing, and so the constraints of our body is not something permanent. And if you take death, we are all going to face death. If you consider life from that perspective, when after death, a period of rest, and then we come back to life, we find that our whole body, our circumstances, the family, the nation, our fortunes and misfortune, everything would have undergone a change. So, for a philosopher, it is not the external circumstances and conditions of the body which he thinks is the cause of bondage, but he traces it to its root. He traces the cause of bondage to its root, which is in the ideas that we hold. Ideas that we hold gives rise to our thoughts, feelings, and action, and repeatedly following one pattern forms our character over courses of life, over course of lives. And for a true philosopher, it is that character of ours, our ideas and thoughts and feelings, which forms the cause of bondage. Take the case of example of a great Stoic philosopher Epictetus in the ancient Greek world. He was born slave. He was a born slave. And if you read his life, you find that he went through a lot of suffering. His master, or one who owned him, was not a nice person, not a good person. He would deliberately harm, cause even physical injury to Epictetus. But in the midst of all such suffering, which we can't even imagine, the mind and soul of Epictetus was free. His body was bound. You may say he was in bondage, he was a slave, but internally he was free. Take the recent other example in our own recent time of the famous Austrian neurophysician, neurologist, Viktor Frankl. He was a Holocaust survivor. For many years he was in the Nazi prison, and the kind of atrocities that were committed and suffering that he had to undergo is something very difficult to read. But in the midst of all this, look at his attitude, look at his frame of mind. This is an example which shows that our mind and our ideas need not be influenced by the circumstances that we are placed in. He says, everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. He says, whatever be the condition in which you are placed, you have the power to always choose your response, your attitude, your perspective towards what you are facing. That cannot be controlled by your captors. So it's not the circumstances of life. Take the other example of Marcus Aurelius. He had all the riches. He was a Roman emperor. All the luxuries of life. And if you read his contemplations, which was all collected, his writings, which was all collected into one book, he was in the midst of warfare. There were Germanic tribes trying to eat into the Roman kingdom, attacking barbarians. There was political conflict back at home. And in the midst of all these court-related problems, political problems, internally he was absolutely calm, just, and internally he was free. It's an example. Like that, we find many such examples which go on to show that we need not be, our minds need not be, you know, influenced or be enslaved by the circumstances in which our body is placed. Now take all the circumstances of life, events of life, our personal fortunes and misfortunes. What is the cause of? We may trace it to various causes, that such and such a person did good to me, therefore I am here. He did bad to me, therefore I am in this position. There was injustice committed by that group of people which has placed me or my family in this position. That is one way of looking at it. But if you probe deeper, you'll find that the only logical, rational explanation of all that we face in life is that we ourselves are responsible for it. The whole and sole responsibility of all the events of our life, our body, everything basically connected to us, is responsibility rests with us alone. Therefore, when we look at it, our life's experiences, the majority of it is not of a happy kind. There is happiness, but the majority of it is not necessarily happy for most of us. Now, these circumstances of life, which we call generally as evil, if we take this and look at it from the perspective of I am this body, then it appears very gloomy, very pessimistic. Life appears very dark. But if you take the a different perspective, a higher perspective, and see the circumstances of life from the point of view of each one of us being a spark of divinity, sojourning through this world of matter, through repeated births and deaths. And none of this actually has the power to affect us, to harm us. And that all these circumstances of life being necessary for our progress as spiritual beings, if we take that perspective, then our whole life becomes completely full of meaning and we get a certain cheerful attitude towards life. So, which is why in the Secret Doctrine, beautiful sentence, a beautiful idea is explained, where it says, evil is the tool of good. Evil is the tool of good. What we call as evil, the experiences which are so bitter to us, mostly it is those experiences which can teach us anything. experiences which are full of happiness and cheer, laughter, those generally can't teach us much, though there are lessons implicit in that also for a discerning student. So evil is the tool of good, that's what ST says. So looking at liberation and bondage from this perspective, we find that taken a wrong perspective, whole of life is a bondage. In a way it is true, because our essential nature is divine. As somewhere Plato or somebody says, the very nature of the soul is freedom. Our very essential nature is freedom. And that being the case, any existence, any kind of body that we inhabit is a bondage. In that sense it is true, it is bondage, but not from the point of view of the soul going through all these experiences for a grand purpose. Which is why in the Upanishads, in the Taittiriya Upanishad, the simile given is very beautiful. Somewhere it says that each of us is like a bee gathering honey from various flowers. In each of our life, at the end of it, we would have gathered some honey and lot of useless things. So it is the honey that we take, like the bee extracts the honey from the flower and leaves the other unnecessary parts of the flower to die. Similarly, each one of us are going through life's experiences gathering the honey, which is spiritual wisdom, our virtues, our good qualities that we ought to develop. So this is so well explained in this article. I will just read this small section on how our very difference, our very attitude towards life makes a world of difference, a world of change. This small section, it says, as mankind multiplies and with it suffering, which is the natural result of an increasing number of units that generate suffering, sorrow and pain are intensified. We live in an atmosphere of gloom, but this is because our eyes are downcast and riveted to the earth with all its physical and grossly material manifestations. If instead of that, man proceeding on his life journey looked but within himself and centered his point of observation on the inner man, he would soon escape from the coils of the great serpent of illusion. From the cradle to the grave, his life would then become supportable and worth living, even in its worst phases. This is why Marcus Aurelius gives the example in his writings that, see, he's speaking to himself. He says, you have the court and the kingdom to take care, but you also have your higher pursuit, he calls the philosophy, which is aspiration towards his higher nature and following the behest of his higher nature. Just like we take the food for our body to sustain the body, similarly the inner nature needs the right kind of food, which is provided by the right philosophy of life. Without that, there is starvation. The person may be in a very luxurious circumstance and he may have great social eminence and political power over the masses. But unless this inner life is attended to, the life that he has lived, the end of it will be a waste. He may have gathered a lot of things, but it becomes so much of a burden because he is a soul. He is a spiritual being. Mistake ourselves to be material, physical bodies, and then generate so much of causes for misery and suffering for ourselves and others. All thinking that we are pursuing the path of happiness, whereas we are pursuing the path of sorrow, sowing the causes for sorrow. So coming back to Marcus Aurelius, he says, there is a court to take care, the kingdom to take care, but there is philosophy also. So he draws the analogy between having a stepmother and a mother. Your external life, your duties towards the society, towards your employer, towards your family, all these duties ought to be performed. They are not to be escaped from. But there is a higher duty, which is the duty towards your higher, duty towards your the divinity within. It is from that perspective that all the other duties have to be performed. So he says, just like when you have stepmother and a mother, you will take care of your stepmother as good as your mother, right? You don't do any distinctions between them. You take care of all her needs, but for comfort and consolation, you go to your mother. Similarly, all the external duties of life that you ought to do, you do it. But your center of observation, as it is said here, is the inner man, the spiritual man, your true nature. So beautifully he explains this. Now coming back here, the teacher further says, pessimism, that chronic suspicion of lurking evil everywhere, a constant anxiety, constant feeling that there is some evil somewhere which will come and touch me, which will come from this person, that circumstance, when things change, that harm will come, right? So pessimism, that chronic suspicion of lurking evil everywhere, is thus of a twofold nature and brings fruits of two kinds. It is a natural characteristic in physical man and becomes a curse only to the ignorant. It is a boon to the spiritual. It is a boon to the spiritual inasmuch as it makes the latter, that is a spiritual man, turn into the right path and bring him to the discovery of another as fundamental a truth, namely, that all in this world is only preparatory because transitory. Whole of our life, when seen from a personal point of view, complete darkness. But you see the same events of life from view of you being an immortal entity who has temporarily taken up this body for a grand purpose. Then events of life takes a different colouring altogether. So all in this world is only preparatory because transitory. It is like a chink in the dark prison walls of earth life. Body is a prison wall. There are small chinks through which sunlight comes and gives us hope. It's like that. It is like a chink in the dark prison wall of earth life, through which breaks in a ray of light from the eternal home, which, illuminating the inner senses, whisper to the prisoner in his shell of clay of the origin and the dual mystery of his being. So, seen from this perspective, there is no evil outside. There is no question of finding evil in the outside person, another person at all. No circumstances of life is pure evil. if circumstances of life which are so, which may be oppressive to our personal nature, if we see it from the perspective that what is the cause of this, who caused this, you find that at some distant past, we must have through ignorance created some disturbance, and universe is ruled by justice. Cosmos is an expression of justice itself. So when the disturbance has been created, caused, adjustment has to be made to restore back harmony. Just like a thrown stone in the pond disturbs it, then the waves converge back upon the point where the disturbance originated. Similarly, circumstances of life come to us with not with a view to punish us, not with a view to condemn us, but to give us an opportunity to restore harmony, to learn the lessons of life, because as said earlier, all this is preparatory. All this is preparatory. We are all child souls going through this journey of life, learning the lessons. So the mother, who is a law, Mother Nature, brings us our own actions back to us, because it is only by going through those circumstances that we can learn. So there is the innermost aspect of us which is free, spiritual and divine, and then all of us, we are not in this body by accident. This body evolved by us in the long past for this grand purpose of reaching beyond the human stage. We as souls have to pass through this human stage and gather experience from it. It is only through gathering this experience, like bee collecting honey, that evolution to the next stage is possible. Which is why Taittiriya Upanishad, the author exclaims this, "Oh, wonderful, wonderful, I am food, I am food, I am food. I am the eater of the food, I am the eater of the food, I am the eater of the food. The firstborn of the Ratha I am, prior to the gods I am, in the source of the eternal I am. I am the one who distributes myself, refreshing myself therewith. Because I am food and I the eater of the food, I am food and I eat the eater of the food. I am elevated over this whole world, I am radiant as the sun. Whosoever understands this attains liberation." So the two aspects of man. The temporary aspect of man, that is the food. The body, the senses, the mind, and the various experiences that we gather, that we feel, and we act and produce causes for our future experiences. These are all life experiences are food. If you look at man from mere body and the sensorium alone, he is the food. But he is also the higher. In essence, he is the divine. So he is the eater of the food. Eater of the food. And the whole purpose of existence is, as it says here, I am the one who distributes myself, refreshing myself, so on. Whole purpose of existence, this bondage in earthly life, is this understanding that we are that one. In other words, that there is absolutely no difference, no separation between oneself and the whole of the cosmos. It is for that realization that we are undergoing this constant churn, constant experiences of life. Because man is in a very unique position. In the whole, when we say man, please don't think the body again. Man, the word comes from the word manu, manas, which is the thinker. is a very unique position that we are in. See, there is in the evolution of the universe, there are two cycles which meet. One is the ascending arc, wherein the animal, the matter is rising, and then the spirit is descending, the other arc. When spirit descends and the matter ascends, at that junction point is man, where spirit and matter is equilibrized. He has all the powers over the material world, and he has all the potential of growth into the spiritual world. Completely balanced point at this both, when these both curves meet, at the junction point is man. His further growth is the descending, what was descending spirit should become ascending, and what was ascending matter should become descending. In other words, his animal nature, his passions should be curbed and conquered, and his spiritual faculties and tendencies and powers must be allowed to grow and expand. This is the condition of man. So this is very well explained in the Isis Unveiled, where the whole work of nature, the purpose of nature is explained. Please pay attention to this. This is so beautiful. This philosophy teaches that nature never leaves her work unfinished. If baffled at the first attempt, she tries again. When she evolves a human embryo, the intention is that a man shall be perfected physically, intellectually, and spiritually, the top man. Physically because the matter aspect, spiritually because his innermost essence is divine, intellectually because he is a manasic being, mind, which is what distinguishes himself from the other kingdoms of nature. So when she evolves a human embryo, the intention is that a man shall be perfected physically, intellectually, and spiritually. His body is to grow mature, wear out, and die. His mind unfold, ripen, and be harmoniously balanced. His divine spirit illuminate and blend easily with the inner man. No human being completes its grand cycle or the circle of necessity until all these three things are accomplished. And since this cannot be accomplished in one small life, nature, as it, when the work is unfinished, she tries again. So again and again, soul is given opportunity. So we incarnate again and again, take up bodies again and again, till this work is finished. This is the work for which we are all here. As the laggards in a race struggle and plod in their first quarter while the victor darts past the goal, so in the race of immortality, the grand evolution of, the grand scheme of evolution of nature, there are laggards, there are those who dart past to the goal of immortality. So while the victor dart past the goal, so in the race of immortality, some souls outspeed all the rest and reach the end, while their myriad competitors are toiling under the load of matter. Close to the starting point, some unfortunate fall out entirely and lose all chance of the prize. Some retrace their step and begin again. This is what the Hindu dreads above all things, transmigration and reincarnation. That is to be dreaded. But there is a way to avoid it. And Buddha taught it in his doctrine of poverty restriction of senses, perfect indifference to the objects of this earthly veil of tears, freedom from passion, and frequent intercommunication with the Atman, which is soul contemplation. The cause of reincarnation is ignorance of our senses and the idea that there is any reality in the world, anything except abstract existence. From the organs of sense come hallucination, we call contact. From contact, desire. Look at this chain. These are called concatenation of cause and effect. From one cause arises an effect. Which effect is a cause for another effect, which in turn is a cause for another, and so on and so forth. So in the ancient philosophy, there is no God which binds us and throws us into body and makes us incarnate again and again. There is no such God who sits there and then ordains that you face suffering, you face happiness, and so on. Neither is it the effect of the stars and their beneficent or maleficent influence on our life. The sole cause of happiness and sorrow, individually as well as collectively, in the ancient philosophy, which is thoroughly scientific, the sole cause they trace to each man himself. You set up causes and will produce effects. And depending on the nature and the type of cause that you have set, it either leads you to sorrow or suffering or happiness. It either binds you to the body or it liberates you. So liberation and bondage is entirely dependent on our, on oneself, especially on the ideas that we hold. Because the soul, we as the perceiver, is in the same state as our mind is. What is mind? Mind is an instrument which has been evolved to come in touch with nature. Through the mind, we come in contact with the inner senses, the inner body. Through the inner body, the outer body. And through the outer body, we come in contact with nature, outer nature. The experience, as it said, the food. For through that experience, emancipation. Now, when the soul is colored, when the soul is distorted, it is like wearing a specs which is not transparent, which is colored and which produces distorted images. What do we see of the outside world then? If our spectacles or for the lens that we are using is not of the right kind, we see the world in a very distorted way. We see things wrongly, perceive wrongly. That is what is our condition internally. Our minds, with the false ideas and false thinking leading to false action, we constantly produce these causes which bind us. Therefore, you see, any teacher, true teacher, spiritual teacher, he begins with the right philosophy. That is because what binds us is the wrong ideas, and unless the mind is clarified, purified and directed in the right direction, there is no hope. No amount of doing bodily practice or rituals or external ceremonies or meditations is going to help, because what is needed is the right direction for mind. Anyway, coming back to this, look at this concatenation of cause and effect. From contact comes desire. From desire, sensation. From sensation, cleaving to existing bodies. From this cleaving comes reproduction, from disease, decay, death, and so on. What is the cause? The misconception that we are the body. We are the body. The forgetfulness of oneself, one's essential nature, and identifying oneself with the body, that is bondage. That is bondage. So, in the Platonic dialogue, Phaedrus, this is so well explained. Socrates there likens a human soul to a chariot with two horses. One is a white horse, a fair horse, a well-behaving horse. Another is a dark horse, a very unruly horse. Soul is a charioteer who has to balance these both, then go reach his destiny. The analogy he is using here is, he says the dark horse is our desires and passions rooted in ignorance. The white horse, the fair horse, the reasonable one, is reason. Reason. He says the generality of the common mankind, most of us, have this mixture of horses. But those who have reached perfection have converted both these horses into a fair horse, a white horse, which means a higher reason has controlled and conquered the lower passions. So he has entirely purified himself. And he says such a horse of the gods, he calls, such beings have become gods. And such horses obtain wings, such that they travel not only on earth, but they can traverse in the heaven also. All metaphorical speech, metaphorical speech. So, he says, every soul is immortal. All souls are immortal. But the souls of the righteous are immortal as well as divine. So that is the purpose for which we are here. Essentially, we are all immortal. But in order to gain a conscious understanding that we are divine also, consciously understand it, we have taken up this body, this life, deliberately taken up this bondage, we may say, so that we can collectively attain liberation. So friends, we'll stop here and consider any questions or points.